You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected works by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Bhagavad Gita in the West, which consists of two cycles. I'm in the second cycle. This is going to be lecture 12 in the total work. However, in the second cycle, it is lecture 7, given in Helsinki, June 3rd, 1913. It is a fact of nature, though usually ignored by science, that the makeup of human beings makes it impossible for us to know one particular part of our being. As we look upon the world, it roughly shows itself as an ascending scale from the mineral kingdom through the plant and animal kingdoms up to man. It goes without saying that we must assume some creative force behind all the forms we perceive around us in the kingdoms of nature. The point is, however, that as human beings, we can gain knowledge of the world we live in just because the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms are outside of us, and we can observe them. As to all that is within ourselves, we can only know in so far as the same forces are at work in us as are active in the three kingdoms of nature outside us. The forces active within us that transcend those three kingdoms, we cannot know using habitual methods for knowing nature, not in the least. Yet it is just what humans have over and above the kingdoms of nature that enables them to systematically build up knowledge of those kingdoms. Just as little as the eye, i.e., whose purpose it is to see outwardly, can see itself, just so little can humans know what there is in themselves by which they may acquire knowledge. This is a very simple idea, but sound. It is impossible for the eye to see itself, because its function is to look out, and it is impossible for those forces in us that help us acquire outer knowledge to acquire self-knowledge. Further, these very forces represent what it is in the human being that makes it something more than an animal. Materialistic Darwinism easily disposes of this fact by simply leaving out the fact that this special human power to know itself cannot be known by our usual cognitive instruments. Recognizing that this power is unknowable, science denies its existence and accordingly considers humans only in so far as they are still animal. You can see on what peculiar fallacy the illusion of materialistic Darwinism rests. Humans cannot know in themselves those forces that are the actual means of knowledge. But the eye can see another eye, and for this reason, other things being equal, it can believe in itself. With cognition, this is not the case. It would be logically possible for a human being to face another human being and perceive the cognitive faculty that raises human beings above animals. But even that is actually impossible, for the very reasons implied in what we have said previously about the effects of thinking. What does ordinary cognition involve in the outer world? We saw already that it involves a perpetual destruction, a wearing down of the nerve structures in the brain. In other words, if we were to look in life on the physical plane for the facts of cognition, one would find a destructive process in the nervous system. One would not find any creative, constructive process. But the creative forces without which human beings don't even begin to rise above animals cannot unfold in the waking state in ordinary life, which is normally associated with cognition. So these forces must come into effect in such a way as not to interfere with the destruction of the nervous structure. This means that they rest, they are dormant, during our waking time. Consider the important implications of this recognition. The forces one would need in order to recognize the nonsense of materialistic Darwinism are actually asleep from the time we awake to the time we go to sleep. And instead, during that time, we have a destructive process. whereas the creative forces raising humans above animals are resting. The creative forces that form the animal organism are much less perfect than those working on the human organism. During the waking hours, these constructive processes are not active at all, but instead another process continuously destroys precisely that which raises humans above the animal. These creative forces are paralyzed in waking life. They are just not there. So, during the waking hours, the forces that raise humans above animality are asleep. They come into action when we sleep. Everything that was destroyed is restored and completed. Thus it is only in a sleeping person that we can find these creative forces raising humans above animality. We are forced to say, that which restores during human sleep the forces that were eroded in the waking hours, these forces must be the ones that raise humans above animality. True, natural science doesn't know these forces. There is only beginning to be an intuition about them. But science is on its way to revealing these forces with entirely external means. They could only be truly observed if one were to observe the reorganization process that takes place during sleep. Once science learns to distinguish those forces in the human being that go beyond the realm of animality, then it will physically observe, precisely in the sleeping body, the transcendence of animality by human beings. Because one will recognize that the same forces that work creatively during sleep work destructively during waking life. Once science learns to distinguish the human forces of regeneration from what is present in animal bodies, it will recognize that the creative forces active in human life are only awake when the human being sleeps. This means that in true self-knowledge, human creative forces, the truly human forces, can only be perceived when human beings become clairvoyant during sleep, that is, in a person that awakens clairvoyantly in a state resembling sleep. We already mentioned this in the fifth lecture. I said today that to some extent, from the processes observable in a person during sleep, science will in time find indications of the forces whereby the human being transcends the animal, but they will only be indications. When these forces appear to clairvoyant consciousness today, they are seen to be of such a nature that they cannot be revealed to the senses in their true form. It will be possible to deduce their existence from certain scientific facts. Apart from their not being perceptible in their essence, there is quite another reason why it will become possible to discover them, although not to perceive them. These human creative forces have a very special relation to all the other forces of nature. We are here approaching a very difficult subject, but I may possibly clarify it in the following way. Let us imagine we have here the receptacle of an air pump, say a bell jar, and suppose we succeed in making a perfect vacuum inside it. Everyone whose intellect is bound to the world of senses will now say, quote, there is no air inside, only an empty space. We cannot go any farther. There cannot be less than no air inside. Close quote. Actually, that is not true. We can pump until no air at all is left, then go on pumping until we get a space still emptier of air than a vacuum. People dependent on the material world will find it difficult to imagine this close, quote, less than nothing, close quote. It is a bit easier to imagine this in regard to our sensations. Just imagine we are in a forest where many, many birds are singing. We stand in the midst of the bird song. Let us assume we walk farther and farther away. We go out of the woods. We hear the bird song less and less, until the point where we cannot hear it any more. But let us go farther, and the sense of being surrounded in our hearing will fade also. We come to silence. And when we go farther, we come to something that is less than the birdsong, less than the silence, less than the complete peace. As you can see, this second thought, this second image, is much easier to follow than the first. We find it easy to imagine a boundary past which we no longer hear anything. And we can also imagine that we can go farther and hear less than nothing. It is sometimes remarkable how things can be accepted as self-evidences, axioms. Thus we can read in many Western philosophical treatises, there is no such thing as less than nothing. It just can't be. Actually, some people even claim that nothing itself cannot truly exist. Let me turn, however, to a really trivial example. In real life, people have no trouble knowing that in some areas there is indeed such a thing as nothing, and even less than nothing. Suppose you have $10 in your pocket. You can gradually spend them until you have nothing left. In this domain of life, there is a real, quote, less than nothing, close quote. It is often one of the strongest realities. You can go into debt for a few dollars. Everybody is presumably much happier having $2, $3, $4, $5 in their pocket than if they owe $2, $3, $4, $5. In practical life, less than nothing is often more intensely real than the reality of possession. Yet, less than nothing exists in the universe as well as in the above illustration. All philosophical dicta about nothing, however pretentious their form, are really rubbish. They are themselves a kind of ill-defined nothingness. It is true that the physical something that surrounds us can be reduced to nothing, and then, still further, to less than nothing. We must imagine the world that surrounds us, which we know in the forces of nature throughout the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, reduced to nothing, then below nothing. It is then that those forces arise that are creatively active in the sleeping human being. Natural science knows only the external side of these forces. In fact, it holds fast to a mere abstraction about them, and therefore cannot penetrate or appreciate them, because ordinary science is to the reality in the forces of nature as the abstract number 10, for example, is to 10 beans or 10 apples. If we eliminate quality and say that all of these are, in quotes, 10 and nothing else, we are doing what natural science does, making no distinctions, touching only the surface of things. If we form the idea that regenerative forces must build up the organism again in sleep, then science will treat these forces in the same way as a man who, when someone meets him, saying, quote, I have $15 in my pocket, close quote, replies, quote, never mind the dollar part, you have 15, close quote. The speaker leaves out of account the very thing that matters. I mention all this to show how difficult it is and must be for external science to know the truth. It will draw certain conclusions and thus come near the truth. For some persons, this will not be necessary because science will gradually be supplemented by clairvoyant perception that experiences the difference between these forces and those active in the three kingdoms of nature. At present, I cannot deal fully with the superficial objection that animals also sleep. Such objections have little logical value, but people do not notice this, for they judge according to abstract concepts instead of the real nature of things. Introducing animal sleep into the argument would be the same error as if someone were to say, quote, I sharpen my pencil with a knife, and I also shave with a knife, close quote, and another person reply, quote, that is impossible. Knives are there to cut meat, close quote. People are always making that kind of judgment. They think that a given thing must have the same function in different realms of nature. Sleep is an altogether different function in humans from what it is in animals. I wanted to call your attention to forces at work in human nature that we find at first in the regeneration of the sleeping organism. Now, these forces are closely related to other forces that also develop in humans with a certain unconsciousness, the forces having to do with reproduction. We know that up to a certain age, human consciousness is filled with a pure and straightforward unconsciousness of these forces, the innocence of childhood. Then at a certain age this consciousness awakens. From that time onward the human organism is permeated by an awareness of the forces henceforth known as sexual love. What lives as a sleeping force in earlier life, and only awakens at puberty, seen in its original and essential form, is the very same as the forces that in sleep regenerate the outworn forces in the human being. It, however, is hidden by the other parts of human nature in which it is mingled. These invisible forces at work in the human being become capable of either good or evil only when they awaken, but they sleep, or at most dream, until the time of puberty. Since the forces that manifest themselves later must first be prepared, they are intermingled, though not yet awake, with the remaining forces in the organism from birth onward. During this time, human nature is permeated by these sleeping forces. This is what meets us in the child as such a wonderful mystery. It is the sleeping, generative forces that only awaken later on. Those who are sensitive to these things feel something like a gentle divine breath when they find behind the naughtiness, obstinacy, and other more or less unpleasant characteristics a child may have, the same forces that awaken later at puberty, but are held back in childhood. The child's innocent qualities are those of the grown-up person, but in childlike form. One who recognizes them as generative forces feels the breath of divine powers. While, in later life, they appear in a person's lower nature, they are so wonderful because they really breathe the pure breath of God so long as they work in unconscious innocence. We must feel these things and be sensitive to them, and then we shall perceive how wonderfully human nature is composed. The generative forces, sleeping during the tender age of childhood, awaken around the time of puberty, and from then on are still innocently active when at night we sink back into sleep. Thus human nature falls into two parts. In every human being, two persons confront us, the one that we are from the time we awaken until we go to sleep, the other from going to sleep to waking again. In our waking state, we are continually at pains to wear and worry our nature down to the animal level with all that is not pure knowledge, pure spiritual activity. What raises us above humanity holds sway like a pure sublime force within the generative powers as they were during innocent childhood. And then in sleep it is awakened in the regeneration of what was worn away in the daytime. So we have in ourselves one person who is related to the creative forces in humanity and another who destroys them. The deeply significant thing in the double nature of the human being is that behind all that the senses perceive, we have to surmise another person in whom creative forces dwell. This second person is really never there in a pure unmixed form during waking life, or even in sleep. Because in sleep the physical and etheric body still remain permeated by the after effects of waking life, by the disturbing and destructive forces. When at last the latter have been removed altogether, we wake up again. So it has been since what we call the Lemurian Age, the beginning, strictly speaking, of present-day humankind's evolution. At that time, as I describe in greater detail in my title outline of Esoteric Science, the luciferic influence in human nature set in. From this influence there came, among other things, what today compels humans continually to wear and tear themselves down to the animal nature. The other element in human nature, which humans as now constituted do not yet know about, the creative forces in them, came into play in the early Lemurian time before the luciferic impulses entered. We rise in thought from human, in quotes, completion, to human, in quotes, becoming, from human created to human being recreated. In so doing, we have to look back to that distant Lemurian time when the human being was as yet wholly permeated by the creating forces. At that time, humans came into being as they are today and entered a kind of lower nature. If we follow the human race from that epoch onward, we have this double nature continually before us in all that has happened since. Humanity then entered a kind of lower nature. At the same time, as we can see clairvoyantly, by looking back into the Akashic record, there appeared, beside ordinary people who themselves were permeated by the human creative forces, something like a brother or sister soul, a definite soul. It was as though this sister soul was held back, not thrown into the current of human evolution. It remained permeated through and through by human creative forces only, and by nothing else. Thus a certain brother or sister soul, in that ancient time there was no difference, Adam's brother soul, remained behind. It could not enter the physical process of human evolution. It lived on, invisible to the physical world. It was not born the way human beings are born in the flowing stream of this life, because if it had gone through birth and death, it would have been part of the physical human process. It could only be perceived by those who rose to the heights of clairvoyance, who developed those forces that awaken in the state we otherwise know as sleep. In that state, human beings are near the pure forces that live and work in the sister soul. The human being entered evolution, but holding sway above this life, there lived in sacrifice a soul that throughout all the processes of human life never came down in bodily form. It did not strive like ordinary human souls for birth and death in successive incarnations, and it could only show itself to them when in their sleep they attained clairvoyant vision. Yet it worked on humankind wherever they could meet it with special clairvoyant gifts. There were humans who, either by nature or special training in schools of initiation, had this power and were able to recognize the creative forces. Wherever such schools are mentioned in history, we can always find evidence that they were aware of a soul accompanying humankind. In most instances, it was only recognizable in those special conditions of clairvoyance that expand human spiritual vision into sleep consciousness. When Arjuna stood on the battlefield with the Kurus and Pandavas, arrayed against each other, when he felt all that was going on around him and deeply realized the unique situation in which he was placed, it came about that this sister soul spoke to him through the soul of his charioteer. The manifestation of this special soul speaking through a human soul is none other than Krishna. For what soul was it that could instill into humanity the impulse to consciousness of self? It was the soul that had remained behind in the old Lemurian age, when humans entered actual earthly evolution. This soul had often been visible in manifestations before, but in a far more spiritual form. At the moment of which the Bhagavad Gita tells us, we have to imagine a kind of embodiment of this soul of Krishna, though much concealed in Maya. Later on in history, a definite incarnation takes place. This soul actually incarnated in the body of a child. Those of our friends to whom I have spoken of this before know that at the time when Christianity was founded, two children were born in different families, both from the house of David. The one child is mentioned in Matthew's Gospel, the other in Luke's. This is the true reason for the external discrepancies between the two Gospels. Now this Jesus child of Luke's Gospel is an incarnation of the soul that had never before lived in a human body, but is nevertheless a human soul, having been one in the ancient Lemurian age. This is the soul that revealed itself as Krishna. We touch here upon a wonderful mystery. We see how the human soul, as it was before humans descended into the course of earthly incarnations, enters the body of the Luke Jesus child. We understand that this soul could hold sway in the human body only until the 12th year of its life. After that, another soul must take possession, the Zarathustra soul that had gone through all the transformations of humankind. This wonderful mystery is enacted, that the innermost essence and self of humanity, which we have seen hailed as Krishna, permeates the Jesus child of the Luke Gospel. In this child are the innermost forces of humanity, the Krishna forces, for indeed we know their origin. This Krishna root takes us back into the Lemurian time, the very primeval age of humankind. At that time it was one with humanity, before the physical evolution of humankind began. In later time this root, these Krishna forces, flowing together and uniting in the unknown and unseen, worked to bring about the unfolding of each human's inner being from within. Concretely embodied, this root is present within a single being, the Luke Jesus child. And as the child grows up, it remains active beneath the surface of life in this special body after the Zarathustra soul has entered it. Thus, all that the Krishna impulse signifies is incarnated in the body of Luke's Jesus child. What was embodied is related to the forces that are asleep in every child in their sublime purity and innocence until they awaken as the sexual forces. In this child, they can manifest themselves and be active until the age of puberty, when one ordinarily becomes sexually mature. But the body of this child, that had been taken from common humanity, would no longer have been adapted to the forces related to the innocent sexual forces in the child. Thus the soul in the other Jesus child, which was the soul of Zarathustra, that had passed through many incarnations and reached its eminence by hard work and special striving, passed over into the body of the Luke Jesus child, and from then on dwelt in that body. In the 30th year, at the time the Bible describes as the baptism in the Jordan, there comes toward this special human body what now belongs to all humanity. This is the moment indicated in the words, quote, "This is my well-beloved Son. This day have I begotten him," close quote. Footnote, Luke 3:22 and Matthew 3:17. Virtually all translations of this text read as follows, quote, "Thou art my beloved Son, with thee I am well pleased," close quote. End of footnote. Christ now comes toward the physical body from the other side. In the body that stands before us here, we have in concrete form what yesterday we thought of abstractly. What belongs to all of humankind comes to the body that contains what, through another impulse, has brought the inner human being to the highest ideal of individual strength and will carry it to yet greater heights. When you consider all that has been said today, leading up, as it does, to a certain understanding of that great moment pictorially represented as the baptism by John, you will have to admit that our anthroposophical outlook takes nothing away from the sublime majesty of the Christ idea. On the contrary, by shedding the light of understanding upon it, much is added to all that can be given to humankind exoterically. Today I have endeavored to present the matter in such a way as to give it sense and meaning for those who can consider it with an open mind in the light of external human history. That is not the way, however, by which this secret was found. Someone might ask, in view of the lectures about Luke's Gospel I delivered years ago in Basel, when, for the first time, I drew attention to the different genealogies of the two Jesus children, quote, why did you not explain then all you have added to it now? Close quote. Footnote, Basel, September 15th to the 25th, 1909, see title, According to Luke, the Gospel of Compassion and Love Revealed. Introduction and notes by Robert McDermott, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, Steiner Books, 2001. and an aside from the reader that is also on this website, and a footnote. That depends on the whole way these things were discovered. Actually, this truth has not yet been found in one single and complete whole by the human understanding. It was not discovered in the form in which I have tried to convey it today. The truth itself was there first, as I indicated in a lecture a few days ago, and the rest followed of its own accord, adding itself to the main body of this piece of knowledge about the two Jesus children. From this you may gather that in the anthroposophical movement for which I am permitted to stand before you, there is nothing of the nature of intellectual or logical construction. I do not mean to lay this down as a general rule for everybody, but I do regard it as my own personal task to say nothing that is given by the intellect as such, but to take things in the way they are directly and immediately given to esoteric vision. Only afterward are they permeated with the power of understanding. The truth about the two Jesus children was not discovered by external historical research, but from the beginning it was an esoteric fact. Afterward, the connection with the Krishna mystery was revealed. You see in this how the science of the human being will have to work into the esoteric realm in the age we are entering. How the fundamental impulses of earthly evolution will gradually be understood and realized by individual persons, and how this will throw more and more light on all that has happened in the past. True science will not only speak to the intellect, but will fill the whole soul. It is when we make ourselves acquainted with esoteric facts that we have a feeling for the real majesty, the greatness and wonder of these facts. Truly, the more deeply we penetrate the world of reality, the more we have this feeling of wonder. Not only our intellect and reason, but our whole soul is illumined when we let truth come to us in this way. Especially at such a point as this, the wondrous event when the whole inwardness of humanity lived in a human body, when a soul that had developed upward to this point through the whole course of earthly life took possession of this body, into which there came, during 3 years of its life, something that was vouchsafed to all humankind from the great universe beyond. Truly, this can stir our souls to their depths. The spiritual age that is dawning will in time make it possible to deepen our understanding still more. One thing is essential to the coming spiritual age. We must learn to take a different attitude toward the great riddles and secrets of the cosmos, to approach them not as in the past with reason and intellect alone, but with all the faculties of our soul. Then we shall ourselves become partakers in the whole of human evolution. It will be for us like a fountain of sublime all-human consciousness. We shall have fullness of soul. We shall feel that we may belong to that humanity that over all the earth is to develop such impulses as have been the subject of our thoughts today. The end of Lecture 12, also Lecture 7 in the second part of this book.